The battle was going well, so much so that the man born as Simon Hamilton Logan, but now known to his followers simply as the Necromancer, decided it was time for phase two. He and his acolytes changed their clothing and swiftly climbed inside the two vans that would take them to the other side of the commandery grounds, where a small cemetery awaited their attention. The driver in the lead van parked behind a small grove of trees to the left of the cemetery, shielding it from the manor house that served as the commandery's main operations center. The other van parked just behind the first. Eight figures emerged from the vehicles, all of them dressed in the same dark robes. Two reached back into the rear vehicle and dragged out a young woman, her hands bound behind her back and a gag in her mouth. The drugs they'd given to her made her docile, but also required that she be supported on either side in order to walk. A few of the men carried shovels. Two of them lugged large duffel bags over their shoulders, while another led a young black Labrador on a leash. Logan was attired in a similar manner as the others, though his robe was made of finer materials, and it had a number of cabalistic symbols sewn into it in gold thread. He listened for a moment to the sounds of combat drifting through the night air from the direction of the manor house, and smiled in satisfaction. All was going according to plan. He gave the signal and the group moved out among the gravestones, their flashlights briefly illuminating the face of each marker before moving on to the next, obviously seeking one in particular. With eight of them looking, it took less than 10 minutes. While those with the shovels went to work on the grave, piling the dirt beside the headstone, two others began to lay out large circles made of salt from the supplies drawn out of the duffel bags, one circle around the grave itself, and another several yards away on a bare patch of earth. Each circle was precisely 9 feet in diameter, and both were left temporarily incomplete. Logan stood to one side, watching. Things were finally ready.
Bring the dog forward. Place him in the second circle.
The dog was laid on its side on the ground, and its legs tied together. The drugs it had been given earlier kept the dog docile and quiet, despite the restraints. The diggers reached the coffin. One of them climbed out of the open grave and helped the circle makers erect a block and tackle set over it. The loose ends of the rope were thrown down to those below and secured around the coffin they had just unearthed. 5 minutes later, it was raised high enough to be dragged over the lip of the pit and settled on the ground beside it, well within the circumference of the salt circle. Logan smiled with satisfaction. It was time for the ritual to begin. The woman was brought forward and deposited next to the casket, where one of the men knelt to tie her feet. As the rest of the men stepped away from the casket and moved to stand behind the smaller circle several yards away, one of them took up a handful of salt and closed the circle that now surrounded the casket and the woman. He then rejoined the others, sealing the entire group inside a circle of their own. Logan used more of the salt to draw a series of Sumerian symbols around the inner circumference of the circle, symbols that a month ago he hadn't known even existed. When he was finished, he used the small remaining portion of salt to close the circle behind him, sealing himself, his assistant, and the dog inside its protective barrier. The assistant readied the rest of the equipment, set up a small folding table, covered it with a swath of fine silk, and arranged the bowls and the obsidian athame, or ritual knife, in the necessary sequence. The dog was next. It was tied down to the tabletop, its legs stretched in both directions, leaving its belly exposed. As the other man worked, the necromancer considered the rite he was about to perform. He never would have been powerful enough to handle. Nor would he have had the aid of the men around him, men who had been seduced by his connection to the demonic and joined him in forming the Council of Nine. Yet the other needed them as well, needed human servants to carry out those tasks that it was prevented from handling on its own, like invading the holy ground of a Templar commandery. It was a partnership made of a mutual desire and greed for power, one that Logan fully understood and encouraged. When it was all said and done, he would be that much more powerful, more capable of carrying out his own plans of conquest. For him, power was the ultimate reward. Now that he had it, he knew that he would do anything to keep it. Anything. He stepped over to the table. The assistant had finished with the necessary preparations, having added 2 golden bowls, an incense burner, and a variety of herbs to what was already on the table. as his assistant set a heady combination of belladonna, mandrake, henbane, and opium burning in the incense dish, the rest of the council began to chant. Obscurum consurum occultum orbis. An electrical tension filled the air, similar to that felt before a summer storm. Yet what was looming was far less benign than such a simple act of nature. A wind kicked up suddenly, sliding amongst the gravestones, setting the ends of the council members' robes fluttering in its breeze. Logan raised the obsidian knife high over his head. He slashed the canine's throat. Blood flowed, hot and wet in the night air. The assistant stepped in with the smaller of the two bowls, catching the streaming liquid. Logan used his knife again, this time on the dog's exposed stomach, slashing it open from stem to stern, working quickly so that he could complete the ritual before the dog died. Setting the knife down on the table, he turned back and plunged his hands inside the still warm carcass, drawing forth handfuls of entrails. These he smeared liberally about his face and neck, breathing in the thick scent of death and the coppery smell of freshly spilled blood, using the physical senses to activate his arcane ones, linking him with the realm of the dead. With a snap, power suddenly flooded through his body, and he grinned at the sheer thrill of wielding such might. He felt it coalesce in the air around him like a living, breathing creature, and with a sharp thrust of both his arms, he flung it outward to strike the exposed coffin. Templar Knights Stan Gibson and Neil Jones had been separated from their unit in the confusion of the surprise assault on the commandery, and found themselves wandering on the outer periphery of the battle.
What is that?
Gibson turned his head and glanced toward where his partner was pointing. A bright glow of greenish-colored light could be seen playing across the grounds. Curiosity got the better of them. Moving carefully and staying in the trees as much as possible, the knights crossed the distance to the cemetery. They approached the gate slowly, using hand signals to inform each other of their intentions. Jones slipped through the gate first, while Gibson covered him with a shotgun before following behind. Surprisingly, the spirit Logan was calling forth fought back with a power almost equal to his own. He could feel the spirit resisting his call to return to its former body, fighting his commands to cross the barrier and answer his summons. Frustrated, the necromancer increased his efforts. It quickly became a battle of wills. Logan's arcane power pitted against the righteous nature and faith of the former Templar Knight, each side refusing to give in. Power spat and crackled inside each of the circles, and the smell of burning ozone filled the air. The necromancer forced more of his power back down the link that connected him to the Shade, and still the knight sought to avoid being called from his rest for so nefarious a purpose. As a result, the energy began to spill over, no longer affecting just the target grave, but those in the immediate vicinity as well, seeping down into the earth to affect coffins on all sides. Where the bodies inside them were too decayed to support their return, the indistinct forms of apparitions began to appear, hovering over their gravestones or rising slowly out of the ground. The council ignored the presence of the specters, knowing they'd be safe, locked within their protective circle. At that moment, Gibson and Jones appeared from out of the darkness and walked into full view of the necromancer, the council, and the specters. Nothing they had been taught could ever have prepared them for the sight.
Mary, Mother of God!
Around them hovered those phantoms that had returned from the other side, only to find that their bodies could no longer contain them. These wraiths were less distinct, flashes of ghostly luminescence that flickered in and out of existence. Gibson could see that their faces were strangely distorted, as though they'd been twisted and pulled in different directions at once. They stared out at him through dark iris sockets. Then, the dead came at them in a rush. Well, have been whistling Dixie for all the good their fire did them. Gibson's shotgun knocked several of the revenants off their feet with its sheer power, but those behind simply charged forward over the bodies of their brethren without hesitation, even as those that had fallen struggled to get back to their feet. The specters were immune to the officers' bullets and quickly swarmed forward. perhaps, and not at his understanding. The two men turned to run, only to find that the dead were on all sides. Something spectral clawed at Gibson's face, opening a large furrow in his cheek, while at the same time, a sudden pain flared in his leg. He looked down to find a revenant with its rotting teeth clamped around his ankle. When he lowered the shotgun to blast the creature into obscurity, others rushed forward, grasping at him. Gibson went down in a pile of bodies. Jones' pistol went silent at that point as he used up the last of the ammunition he was carrying. The spectacle over, the necromancer turned his attention back to his task. He could feel the spirit weakening, could feel the struggle shifting in his favor. So he reached down for his reserves and poured more energy into the fray, and won the struggle. A moment later, the lid of the coffin was thrown violently open from the inside. A hand spotted with mold was thrust up into the night air.
Arise!
The revenant inside the casket obeyed, forcing itself upright to stand on wobbly legs. As it stepped clear of the casket, its gaze fell upon the woman, lying bound and gagged at its feet. The creature threw itself upon the offering and began to feed. They were awoken before dawn with the report of another attack, this time in Ohio. Less than 20 minutes after being informed of this new development, Echo Team was airborne, headed for the site of the latest confrontation. Driven to the airport by the same novice who delivered the note, they found one of the Order's Gulfstream IV aircraft waiting for them, courtesy of the Perceptor. Within moments of their arrival, the group boarded the plane and took off. Like most of the Order's equipment, the interior of the aircraft was Spartan. Gone were the leather seats and the recessed minibars, the in-flight entertainment centers, and the four-star meals. Only the bare necessities had been spared, though the privacy curtain that separated the main compartment from the smaller private compartment to the rear remained. Riley was up front with the pilot.
So, what's your story?
Duncan looked up from the magazine he was idly flipping through and across the aisle to where the other man was seated.
My story?
Olson was older than Duncan, though not by more than a few years. He carried himself with the assured confidence of a man who had seen and conquered all that life had thrown in his path. His rust-colored hair was cut short in military fashion, and his beard was trimmed so that it neatly framed his narrow face.
Yeah, you know, where you from? Why you joined this crazy outfit in the first place?
Oh, not much to tell. I was born and raised in Georgia. Undergrad and grad degrees in religious studies. Then spent some time in the missionary field before being asked to join the Order.
Missionary work, huh? Where?
Mostly in Southeast Asia, Thailand, Laos. Even spent about 6 months in mainland China.
Nick must have picked up on his discomfort, for he didn't pursue that point further.
Huh. How long you been in?
10 years. 3 in the General Forces, and the last 7 on the protection detail for the Perceptor. I've seen my share of things get ugly, but I'll be the first to admit it pales in comparison to Echo Team's exploits. From the unit's records, you seem to see combat fairly often.
You bet your ass we do. More than any other unit. When the higher-ups can't figure out how to solve something, they call us in. This new job might seem quiet now, but I guarantee it's gonna get sticky or we wouldn't be here.
Can I ask you something, then?
Nick opened his mouth, but before he could reply, his laptop intruded.
Son of a... Yeah, go ahead. I'm still listening.
So how do you feel about working for him?
Nick stopped what he was doing and eyed Duncan in silence.
What you really mean is what it's like working for the heretic, right?
Well, he does have a certain reputation.
Let me give you a piece of advice. If you're going to be part of this squad, then you need to get something straight, and it's best you do it from the start. In our unit, no one ever calls Cade the heretic. It's a bullshit name given to him by someone not even fit to be in the same room with him. You'll understand that the first time you find yourself facing something that belongs inside someone else's nightmares, and it's Cade that saves your ass. I'm not trying to be hard on you, Even I have to admit that things are a little, different on the team. Kate doesn't always follow the rule precisely to the letter, and he has certain abilities that, frankly, scare the hell out of me sometimes. But that doesn't mean I don't respect him, or that he doesn't deserve my respect. He's the best damn commanding officer I've ever served under, that's a fact.
So the stories are true?
It depends on which ones you're talking about.
From his position at his work area in the rear cabin, Kate could hear the soft hum of conversation between Sergeant Olson and their new team member, reminding him that he had yet to go over the man's personnel file. He turned away from his research in the Apostolic Isatis and opened his laptop. Powering it up, he called forth Duncan's service records. He skimmed over the early details. Born and raised in Georgia, the son of a preacher, homeschooled for most of his elementary years, attended a parochial high school and later a Jesuit university, where he majored in religious studies. It was all fairly ordinary. Instead, Kate focused on the present, noting the short span of time Duncan spent in seminary before an unexpected departure for the Orient and a long missionary tour, then the equally short courtship to bring him into the order. His zeal and desire to succeed once he had been christened a knight was evident, and his service record over the last 10 years was exemplary. He'd been selected early on to serve on the protection detail and had remained there, rising to his present position as detail command 3 years ago. A series of photographs were included as scanned images embedded into the report, and Kate took the time to study each of them in turn, hunting for evidence that his hunch had been right, that the flash of power he'd seen centered on Duncan's hands in the preceptor's office was an earthly indicator of his ability to heal with just a touch. He stopped to look more closely at one of the older photographs. The image was creased and worn. Whoever had scanned the photo didn't bother to clean it up. It was clear enough, however, to show a young Sean Duncan standing unhappily in front of an older man dressed in a suit. Duncan looked to be around 10 or 11 years old. The man, looking stern and serious, rested his hands on young Sean's shoulders. The pair stood beneath the entrance to a revivalist tent, the sign marking the doorway, partially obscured by the older man's arm.
Special engagement tonight and tonight only. Pastor Patrick Duncan, faith healer. Now we're getting somewhere.
Kate printed a hard copy of the photo and settled back in his chair, staring at the photo as if it might suddenly reveal some long-lost secret that only Cade would understand. Perhaps, in a way, it did. Duncan was startled out of a light sleep by a hand on his shoulder. It was Nick.
Boss wants to see you.
He gestured to the smaller cabin at the back of the plane, where Cade had been sequestered since the flight began. Nick returned to his seat. Duncan unbuckled his seatbelt, walked down the aisle, and drew aside the curtain hanging at the end of the forward cabin. The lights were on low, but provided enough illumination that Duncan could see the area served as a functional workspace. The standard aircraft seats, like those in the forward cabin, had been taken out. In their places were two reclining chairs with a table between them and a large drafting-style work table. The lights were on over the work table, shining down on several stacks of papers, a few open reference books, and a long black case. Williams was nowhere in sight. Noting that the lavatory lights on the rear wall were illuminated, Duncan guessed that Cade would be back momentarily. His curiosity getting the better of him, he made his way over to the work table. The books were old, centuries so if the fine calligraphic script and the carefully drawn illustrations in the margins were any indication. A glance at the text revealed it to be Latin, a confirmation of the authenticity and age of the volumes. Judging by the images and the few snatches of text he quickly translated, each of the books dealt in some fashion with angels and demons. His own personnel file lay closed on the table nearby. Resisting the urge to peek inside it, he turned his attention instead to the long, narrow case that rested on the table beside them. It was a sword case. Duncan had no difficulty identifying it, for he had one of his own. Every knight in the order did. They were given out by the seneschal during the investment ceremonies, a symbol of the oath of fealty that each man gave as he joined the order. But Cade's was different. Where Duncan's case was made from simple black fiberglass without ornamentation, Cade's was covered with a soft, supple skin of dark leather and held shut with three simple silver clasps. In the center of the lid, a word had been branded into the covering, its harsh, rough edges providing a stark contrast to the rest of the case's beauty. The word was in a language Duncan did not recognize. He glanced up at the lavatory lights, saw that they were still lit, and gave in to a sudden impulse. He reached down and opened the case. Inside, lying on a bed of smooth white silk, was Cade's sword, as Duncan had expected. The weapon itself was an unadorned English longsword. Along the length of the blade that was facing upright in the case, the word Defensor had been inscribed in silver. Latin again, and easily identifiable to Duncan. Translated, it meant defender. It was etched into every sword carried by the Templars, for that one word neatly formed the foundation of the Order's mission, to defend mankind against the evils in the world. Awed by the beauty and craftsmanship that went into creating this particular weapon, Duncan couldn't resist. He reached down and carefully withdrew the sword from the case. He held it up in the aisle, turning it slightly to and fro so that the dim lighting of the cabin made the script sparkle and shine. Doing so, he noted something else. On the opposite side of the blade, a second word had been inscribed in a fashion similar to the first, Ulciscor.
Vengeance.
Seeing it made Duncan pause, both for its very presence and what it said about the weapon's owner. According to the code, a knight was allowed personal ownership of only a few specific items. The sword given to each of them during the investiture ceremony was one of them, a symbol of their fidelity to the Order and their unrelenting dedication to its ideals. The weapons were supposed to remain undecorated, chaste if you will. Enhancing the weapon in any manner after it's awarded is cause for a variety of punishments, for doing so is considered a sin of pride. Duncan's new commanding officer had clearly ignored this aspect of the rule. How many others did he ignore? Duncan didn't have time to ponder the answer.
You like it?
The younger knight almost dropped the weapon in surprise as he looked up, to find his new commander leaning against the door of the lavatory, watching him. Embarrassed to be caught, Duncan quickly replaced the sword in its case. Cade moved farther into the cabin and took a seat in one of the reclining chairs, gesturing with one gloved hand for Duncan to do the same.
Tell me about your gift.
What?
Duncan's eyes followed Cade's gloved hands as his new commander reached up and removed his eye patch.
Could you heal this?
Duncan was unable to look away. The destruction to the right side of Cade's face was worse than Duncan had expected. It appeared as if someone had taken a blowtorch to the tender flesh around his eye socket, the skin flowing and surging together in a grotesque parody of the natural order of things. The eye itself was still intact, but was nothing more than a milky white orb floating in a sea of damaged flesh.
Good Lord.
Duncan's hands drifted up from his lap toward Cade's ruined face, seemingly of their own accord, but he snatched them down again as soon as he realized they were in motion. He glanced away, unable to continue to meet his commander's gaze.
No, I couldn't heal that.
Why not?
It's too old. I can only heal things that are fresh, tissue that hasn't scarred over. I'm sorry.
Don't be. I'm long since over it. I was more interested in your reaction than anything else.
You were testing me.
Of course. Does the Order know?
It's not general knowledge, but yeah, it's probably in my file somewhere.
Have you tested its limits?
Duncan's mind swept back over the years spent overseas, the endless lines of the sick and the injured, the bright sparkle of hope in their faces, their utter belief that he and he alone could heal them of their afflictions.
Yes, I've tested it.
Cade nodded, but didn't push him any further, for which Duncan was grateful.
I suspect that you're going to learn a lot in the next few months. Things that you will probably wish you'd never learned. You'll see things the ordinary man will most likely never see. But that is one of the crosses that we bear in service to the Order. I'll expect you to do your duty no matter what the situation. If you can do that, you'll have the respect of every man in this unit. Understood?
Yes.
You've probably heard a lot about me. Some good, some bad, I'll wager. I won't comment on any of that except to say that I'll expect you to make up your own mind. Like you, I have certain abilities. Abilities that not everyone understands. Sometimes I'm forced to use them in ways others would consider unconventional. But I took the same oath to the Order as you did. Remember that. As you know, Echo Team is made up of 4 squads plus a command unit. Martinez is in charge of first squad. Wilson has second. Baker and Lyons have third and fourth squad, respectively.
Cade continued by spending several minutes going over the standard operating procedures in the unit. Hand signals, radio call signs, and the like. After a time, he dismissed him to get some sleep before they landed. As Duncan was leaving, Cade spoke up once more.
Let's keep your ability between the two of us for now. It's probably better that way. No sense in making the men uneasy, right?
Duncan couldn't imagine how his own healing ability would make men who called the heretic their leader uneasy, but he nodded nonetheless. Cade smiled and then leaned back into his chair. The darkness around him seemed to swallow him whole. The dream came quickly. In reality, the events had played out in horrible slowness. In the dream, they always flashed past like a strobe light, one scene after another in endless succession.
Williams here. Go ahead, dispatch.
Urgent call from your wife, Kate. Says she needs you to call her on the landline.
Will do, dispatch. Thanks for the relay.
Kid replaced the mic and turned to Jackson.
She probably wants me to pick up some milk and bread on the way home.
He dialed. He hung up and tried again. He frowned, a small tendril of unease unfurling itself in his gut. He turned to Jackson.
I know I'm supposed to drop you off first, but would you mind if we go straight to my place? I can't get Gabby on the phone.
It'll cost you a beer or two.
The interior lights were all out. Something was wrong. Cade parked in the driveway behind his wife's Audi. His partner and he got out of the car, Cade turning to say something. Whatever it was, the words never left Cade's mouth.
God damn!
Jackson suddenly buckled. A single flash of light came from the living room window off to his right, and Cade knew that Jackson had been taken down by gunfire.
Run! Cade, run!
Gabrielle!
Cade drew his gun and crouched behind his open car door, looking across the front seat to where Jackson lay slumped against the door, half in and half out of the vehicle.
How bad?
It hurts, but it's a clean through and through. He didn't hit anything vital. I'll call for backup.
But Cade was no longer listening. He leapt to his feet and rushed the front door, hoping his severe departure from standard police procedure would catch their assailant off guard, long enough for him to make the safety of the porch. Now he was inside. The laugh was coming from the kitchen, down the hall in front of him. The light from that room spilled out into the hallway, and movement in the shadows cast on the floor let Cade know that there were at least two people in there. With his gun held out before him in a shooter stance, he entered the room, a look of confidence on his face and fear in his heart. Cade knew the man standing in his kitchen with a pistol at his wife's head. Not personally, but he knew him nonetheless. He'd just spent the last 5 hours staring at his likeness in a police sketch, for he was wanted in connection with several recent homicides. What Cade didn't understand was what the hell the Dorchester slasher was doing in his home, threatening his wife. Cade's arms moved slightly, and his aim settled on the center of the intruder's forehead.
What do you want?
What do I want?
Look, I can get you whatever you want.
Cade indicated the radio on his belt.
All you've got to do is tell me what it is you want and let the woman go. We can work this out.
Aren't you even curious, Officer Cade?
I'm sorry?
Aren't you curious about why I'm in your house? Why I shot your partner and am holding your wife hostage? Aren't you curious about why I'm going to kill you both?
Gabby's eyes widened. The bullet tore through the right side of the slasher's forehead. Cade walked over and put his arms around her, holding her tight.
Cade! Cade!
We're in here! We're okay.
1 minute the slasher was lying on his back, the next he was standing beside them. Before any of them could react, he grabbed Gabby with one hand on either side of her head. Wrenching her away from Cade, he shoved his face against hers. An inky blackness swirled forth from the corpse's mouth, enveloping Gabby's face. Cade forced himself into motion, intent on getting that horrible thing away from his wife. And though he knew he was moving with his usual agility, each second seemed to pass with excruciating slowness.
Out of the corner of his eye, he could see Jackson's hand reaching for his weapon, taking what seemed like hours to move only a few inches. The thing released his wife, casting her away from itself across the room. Her face a mess of raw flesh and blood, the outer layer of skin torn off. As she fell, Kate could see her eyes were fixed and staring, and he knew in that second that he had lost her. His hand reached for his weapon as the corpse in front of him began shaking violently. A crack suddenly appeared in the thing's forehead, starting at the bullet wound and flowing like rainwater down across its face. As Kay dragged his weapon free of its holster, the corpse's hands moved with dizzying speed and shoved its fingers into either side of the crack on its face. Pulling sharply in both directions, it split its own skull in two, revealing the thing that lingered beneath. For just a moment, a face could be seen, with eyes a deep crimson and teeth gleaming blood red in the room's light. A malevolent smile crossed its face as it pulled the corpse's flesh down and away from its own. A hint of wings could be seen as it sought to drag itself free from the fleshly remains in which it had been hiding. Cade's hand came up, the pistol and its centering once more on its target. Peripherally, he could see Jackson's weapon doing the same, but Cade never had a chance to pull the trigger. With a flick of its hands, the thing was free. The rest of the bodily remains flung away in either direction. One long clawed hand swung around and locked on Cade's, trapping his gun in its iron grip. The other hand slapped against the side of Cade's face. An inky black cloud of darkness flowed out of its hands and onto Cade's skin, burning his flesh with the intensity of molten steel. He could feel the flesh on his face and hand melting away. In front of him, those eyes glowed with intelligence and an awful, inhuman glee. Cade sat upright. He could feel the sweat running down his neck and pooling in the middle of his back beneath his shirt. As he tried to center his thoughts, something moved in the darkness of the compartment. He reacted the second he sensed the intrusion, moving out of the chair and into a crouch before it, balanced on the balls of his feet.
Cade.
Just a word. One simple word, spoken in a voice no louder than a whisper. But a word that had all the power in the world when spoken by the woman he had loved, more than life itself.
Gabby.
When the figure did not respond, Cade reached beneath the shade of the lamp on the table next to him and turned on the switch. In the sudden light, Cade discovered that he was alone. The figure, if it had ever been there, was gone. Logan climbed the cellar stairs, the howl of the revenant below causing a smile to dance upon his lips. They'd taken several of the Templars captive on the off chance that they might be able to reveal something of importance. When they'd refused to answer his questions, he'd had them all slaughtered, then resurrected one at a time as revenants. His questions were posed again. Unfortunately, they'd been telling the truth. None of them had known anything of value. Snatching them hadn't been completely in vain, however, as they were providing some merriment for Logan's acolytes, an experience that would only bond them even more securely to him as their leader. As he moved through the house, headed for his nightly audience with the other, he considered where the plan had taken them so far. The sheer audacity of it all was exhilarating. To steal one of the most powerful artifacts of Christianity right out from under the noses of those who had been tasked to guard it throughout the ages was a thrilling accomplishment. To do it with the help of one of their own was even more exquisite. His smile grew wider at the thought. Leaving the house, he crossed the ground swiftly, a dark shadow against a darker background, with just the light of the moon to guide his way. Behind him, only a slight disturbance in the dew-wet grass marked his passage. Seconds later, that too faded from view. As he neared the old chapel, his pace slowed noticeably. The door stood slightly open to the night air, as he had known it would, just as it was every time he came here. An unspoken invitation. The chapel had once been holy ground, but that was years ago. Any vestige of God that might have once inhabited the place had long since fled.
Countless ceremonies and blood sacrifices had seen to that. The necromancer stepped through the door and moved down the center aisle to the edge of the raised altar platform, continuing around the side to its end. He waited in silence for a moment until a form moved out of the deeper darkness at the rear of the chapel behind the altar, back where the sacristy had once been. It didn't come fully into the light. Indeed, it had never done so in the months since it had first unexpectedly taken up residence here. Once the necromancer had gotten a brief glimpse of the creature, a quick vision of a humanoid form, but that had been all he'd seen before it had retreated into the darkness it seemed to prefer. He hoped never to repeat the experience. Summoning his courage, Logan began.
The search for the spear continues, though we have recently begun to narrow the area of interest. The one they call the heretic has been assigned to the case, just as you predicted, and is even now following the trail we have laid out for him.
Good. You have done as I have asked, then.
The necromancer nodded, knowing from past experience that the other could see him quite clearly, despite the cloying darkness of the chapel's interior.
Set out the bait. It is time we caught our prey.
As you wish.
The necromancer bowed curtly and backed out of the chamber, never taking his gaze away from the thing that stood before him. Despite their temporary partnership, the necromancer had no delusions about the nature of his ally. It would destroy him on a whim, just as it had decided to aid him. He had come too far, was too close to his goal to allow that to happen. He would give it no reason to doubt him. Not until he was ready. The four members of Echo's command team arrived at the Cincinnati International Airport around 6 a.m. local time. A rented Ford Explorer was waiting for them in the private hangar where the pilot parked the aircraft. Their destination was about an hour's drive north, and after transferring their gear into the vehicle, the team wasted no time getting underway. Cade and Olson climbed in back, with Riley behind the wheel and Duncan riding shotgun. Cade stared out the rear passenger window. He couldn't get the echo of Gabby's voice out of his head, calling out his name the night before. But Gabby was dead, and as far as he knew, at rest. In the 5 years since her passing, he'd never once encountered her in the beyond, never had even a single hint that her spirit still languished there. He'd long ago come to the conclusion that she had passed on to whatever version of an afterlife someone of her sweet grace deserved. And yet...
And yet you hope it was her, don't you? You hope it was because you miss her, and every single day living without her seems to be a waste. No matter what it would mean to her, to be trapped in that half state of existence like the phantoms you encounter in the beyond, you still want to believe, don't you?
Grudgingly, Cade had to admit to himself that it was true. Every morning when he awoke to find himself without her was another day in which his heart broke anew. Cade's own views of heaven and hell had been drastically altered when he first looked into the beyond. It would have been impossible for them not to have changed. Raised as a Catholic, he'd believed in an afterlife based on one's faith in the Savior, and had scoffed at notions of ghosts and goblins as far back as he could remember. His encounter with the adversary had changed all that. If he had not discovered the order when he had, he probably wouldn't have survived. His pain, confusion, and fear would have driven him over the edge. The Templars had helped him resurrect a framework around his beliefs, allowed him to hang on to the cherished notion that his wife's soul had moved on to a better place. Those aware of the existence of the beyond suggested it served as a sort of purgatory, and pointed out that a woman as faithful and true as his wife would never choose to stay in such a place. Gradually, they taught him that man was not alone in the world, that there were beings of darkness and destruction that walked among man every day. At least in part, the Order had convinced him that some of his older notions of faith and justice still held sway, that the Templars were the earthly equivalent of a group of guardian angels, appointed by the Church to protect man from creatures such as the adversary. And so he had joined them.
But what if it was Gabby? What then? What did that mean for your cherished beliefs? What if she really was out there? What if she had been there all this time and you hadn't noticed, wrapped up as you are in your hunger for vengeance?
Cade couldn't allow himself to contemplate an answer. If it weren't for his desire for revenge, he probably would have followed Gabby and ended his life long before this. It would have been simpler that way.
But a vow is a vow, and you've still got to fulfill yours. While the adversary lives, the hunt is still on. The hunt is still on.
Putting the question of Gabby's appearance on the back burner for the time being, Cade turned his attention back to the issue at hand.
All right, Olsen, take us through it.
As Nick pulled out his PDA and called up the information, Cade noted approvingly that Duncan gave his teammate his undivided attention. Cade knew without a doubt that Riley was listening as well, despite the fact that the big man didn't take his attention off the road.
Okay. Initial reports show we've got a similar situation to the one we just left in Connecticut. An attack late at night, signs of heavy firefight, no survivors. Two major differences from Ravensgate. This time, the small cemetery in the grounds was disturbed. Most of the graves were torn up and the contents were strewn about. Whatever they were looking for, they were certainly thorough.
Witnesses?
No. And that brings us to the other issue. When the general alert went out, each of the commanderies was required to report back to the preceptor. Templeton did not respond, and so a team was sent out to investigate. They found the place abandoned.
What do you mean abandoned?
While we're assuming the commandery staff are dead, we're not entirely positive. Despite the signs of a major confrontation, there wasn't a single body left at the scene.
There were 88 men stationed at Templeton.
Olsen caught Riley's eye in the rearview mirror.
Yes, there were.
They were met at the gate by several soldiers from the commandery in Falkenberg, some 75 miles to the north. It was the same unit that had been sent to investigate after Templeton's personnel failed to report in following the alert the night before. Cade interviewed them at some length, but they didn't know anything more than they'd already reported. When they arrived, they discovered evidence of a firefight, but found the commandery empty, abandoned. Leaving the Falkenberg troops stationed at the gates, Echo Team made its own swift search of the manor house, confirming what they had been told. The evening meal lay cold in the communal dining hall, half eaten. The armory had been opened, its weapons distributed. Bullet casings and bloodstains littered the floor behind makeshift barricades. But there were no bodies. No survivors. They spent 2 hours in the house, then turned their attention to the cemetery. It had been ransacked, desecrated. Graves had been dug open, the dirt stark against the lush green grass. The unearthed coffins had been ripped apart, their contents spilled across the lawn. A rib cage was jammed between the branches of a newly planted rose bush. An age yellowed skull with its lower jaw missing and one eye socket stuffed with mud lay in the middle of a pedestrian walkway. This was the intentional destruction of hallowed ground, a vile disturbance of sanctified remains that appeared to have no legitimate purpose behind it. Anger stirred in Kate's gut at the sight. A quick examination showed that while most of the graves had been torn up haphazardly, one of them had been carefully excavated. He decided to start there. Duncan stood next to that open grave, ready to assist him if he needed it. Riley and Olsen were several yards away, but facing in the other direction, guarding the approaches in anticipation of trouble. Things weren't right there, and Cade had no intention of being caught unawares. He removed his gloves and placed them in his pocket before kneeling in the earth next to the open grave. The smell of freshly turned earth, moldering death, and stale air met his nostrils, but he barely noticed the stench as he mentally prepared himself to do what must be done. The parapsychologists and those who studied psychic phenomena had a formal name for what he did. Psychometry, they called it. The ability to divine facts about an object or its owner through physical contact. Cade had an easier name for it. He simply called it his gift. It had been 7 years since the gift was thrust upon him, but in that time he still hadn't grown comfortable using it. He wondered if he ever would. It wasn't the loss of tactile sensation that bothered him so much. He'd become accustomed to how things felt through the thin material of his gloves, and it wasn't as if he was unable to touch things at all. When he was at home, safely surrounded by his own possessions, he would often move about the house without his gloves on, doing just that for hours at a time, remembering what it felt like to run his fingers over cut stone, feeling the velvety touch of flour as it sifted between his fingers, holding a book in his hands and testing the quality of the paper between his thumb and forefinger. His home was his sanctuary. No one else was allowed inside, in order to limit the psychic latencies that might be left behind. Only the intimate touch of another human being was unavailable. That level of sustained contact would bring with it such an overwhelming rush of emotional residue that he would be hard-pressed to understand where he ended and his partner began. Had Gabby lived, things might have been different. But in the aftermath of her death, Kate had ceased to care about human contact, at least in that fashion, and so this troubled him far less than others might expect. It was possible that his discomfort with his gift grew from the fact that using it brought a degree of physical danger, though he was never one to shy away from the possibility of physical injury. On past occasions, he had emerged from a session confused, disoriented, at times even uncertain of his own identity. Once, during a particularly violent viewing, he regained consciousness with knife slashes across his chest. He suspected the true reason for his discomfort lay in the way the gift had come to him. There was little doubt that the adversary meant to kill him on that summer night, and had only failed by the smallest of margins. But something had been left behind, some kind of residue or catalyst, that resulted in his gift, his sight. He glanced around, making certain his men were in their proper places. Riley, standing off to his right, returned his look with a somber nod. Olsen, stationed behind him, smiled ruefully. Kate had no doubt that the men had his back. It was the newcomer he questioned. How he reacted about what Kate was going to do would say a lot about his future with the unit. He checked, to be certain that Duncan was where he should be, on the opposite side of the grave, out of immediate reach if he objected to what Kate was doing, but close enough to help if things got hairy. The top of the coffin had been split into several sections, though the bottom remained intact. A large section of the lid rested in front of Cade, its silk lining torn and stained from contact with the mud and debris around it. Reaching out, Cade placed his right hand palm down against the outer surface of a torn and discarded portion of the coffin lid. Darkness. A light breeze rustling the edges of his cowl. The steady motion of the shovel as it went up and down. He was falling behind, and that would never do. He could be punished for that. He needed to hurry up. Anticipation. Excitement. A glimpse of several robed and hooded men staring down into the hole as he worked to complete his task. Would the council get its answer tonight, or would it need to raise another one? He hoped it was the latter. He liked playing God. The images and rush of the others' feelings came and went, there and gone again, before Kate could focus on them. In mere seconds, they had faded from view. Cade removed his hand and shook his head to clear it.
You all right, boss?
Oh, fine.
Cade tested several other places near where he had touched the lid the first time, but any remaining impressions proved elusive. With Duncan looking on curiously, Cade pushed aside the remains of the lid and turned his attention to the casket. The interior lining was stained with mold and other substances that Cade was in no real hurry to identify. The silk itself was faded and dull, evidence that the interment was not a recent one. He found a clear spot large enough to accommodate his hand and reached out to touch the lining. Darkness. Peace. Serenity. Pain. A harsh, savage pain that ripped through his body with all the grace of a hot spear. A force was calling him, demanding his return, but he was too weak to stop himself from obeying. The pain increased, the force grew stronger, until he could barely hear his own screams. Cade yanked his hand away, ending the sensation, and looked up into the face of his new recruit, now kneeling close by, a concerned look on his face.
Are you okay?
Cade nodded.
Just what exactly are you doing?
He's looking into the past.
The past?
Riley nodded, turning his attention back to their surroundings, now that he was satisfied that Cade was all right.
It's one of the reasons those idiots call him the heretic. He receives visions through his touch.
Is that true?
It's a simplification of what really happens, but yeah, it's true.
A more accurate description might be that I experienced the final thoughts and emotions of the last person to come in contact with the object I'm handling. But Riley's explanation works just as well. Except that he forgot to tell you I have no control over it. It happens whenever I touch anything, whether I want it to or not. I'm gonna try again. Try to get a clearer picture of what I'm seeing. Something's not right. If you see something unusual, if I start to shake, bleed, or otherwise look like I'm in danger, I want you to grab me by my shirt and pull me away from the casket. Understand?
Yes.
Welcome to the big leagues, kid.
Cade placed his hand on the remains of the coffin for a third time. A searing hunger coursed through him as he climbed to his feet. A hunger so strong it felt like pain. Ahead of him, he could see the dark-cloaked forms of several people gathered in a circle around another, taller figure. The one in the center was demanding he come forth, demanding he respond to the summons. He was filled with a strong compulsion to obey, but he did his best to ignore the voice. The smell of human flesh so close it made him dizzy with hunger, and all he wanted to do was feed. When he tried to move forward, however, he tripped over something in his path and fell heavily to the ground. Pulling himself back up, his gaze fell to the object on the ground. It was a young woman, bound and gagged, left lying in the dirt at his feet. Her eyes gaped wide. The scent of her sweet skin was strong and filled his nostrils with fear, rich and ripe. All other thoughts forgotten, he pounced. With a jolt, Cade came out of the trance, only to find himself being held to the ground by Riley, the big man's arm around his neck. The sharp taste of blood was strong in his mouth, and he could feel its wetness flowing down his chin. On the ground, a few feet away, sat Duncan, his left arm cradling his right, blood flowing from a small wound on his forearm. Nick was kneeling beside him, trying to stop the flow of blood.
He bit me!
Cade didn't hear him. He pulled himself free of Riley's hold and sat up, moving to face him. Cade now understood what they were facing, and the knowledge filled him with fear.
Revenant. They're raising Revenants.
As the others watched, horrified at what they had just seen and heard, Cade calmly turned and spat Duncan's blood from his mouth. Revenants. Corpses reanimated through the use of dark magic. Souls forced back into decomposing flesh and infused with a taste for living flesh. Abominations against the Lord. After Cade's revelation, the fact that the commandery was empty took on a deeper, more ominous meaning. The dead weren't just missing, and Echo Team had to contend with a very real possibility that the bodies of their brethren had gotten up again under their own power. Being brought back in such a fashion would be terrible for anyone. It would be a particularly hellish experience for the devout knights who had given their lives for the cause. Duncan's mind reeled. Considering what they knew, none of them felt comfortable remaining at the site of the attack. The decision was made to spend the evening at the Falkenberg Commandery, roughly an hour's drive to the west. Back in the truck, with Riley once more behind the wheel, Olsen did his best to bind Duncan's wound while Cade got on the phone to let the others know they were on their way. Duncan turned to Olsen.
Does this kind of thing happen a lot?
No. You're the first subordinate he's bitten.
That's not what I...
Relax, kid. I'm just trying to lighten the mood. Like I said before, the commander's methods can sometimes be a little... unorthodox. But he gets the job done. At least now we know what we're up against.
The sergeant pulled the bandage tight, and the sharp stab of pain that accompanied the move caused Duncan's retort to die stillborn in his throat. Their destination, a small commandery under the control of Knight Captain Noel Stanton, was situated in a heavily wooded and sparsely populated area of Falkenberg. Like many of the commanderies Cade had visited across the United States, this one had been established on the grounds of a large estate. It was separated from the surrounding properties by a large stone wall that encircled it. The entrance lane ran parallel to that wall for some time before they came to the gate, giving Cade plenty of opportunity to scope out the cameras and security devices concealed along its length. They were met at the gate by an armed guard wearing the insignia of a local security company, who questioned them about who they were there to see, then returned to his guard shack, apparently to ring the main desk to be certain they had an appointment. Satisfied with the answer he received over the phone, he opened the gates and waved them through without leaving his shack a second time. If it hadn't been for the signet ring bearing the Templar cross on the guard's right hand, Duncan never would have known he was a member of the Order. Hiding in plain sight was one of the Order's greatest assets, and Duncan knew that the ruse would certainly fool the average passerby. Riley drove through the open gates and down the road leading into the estate proper. The commandery was an older brick mansion with a slate roof and white columns dominating its front entrance. A young initiate was standing on the steps awaiting their arrival when they pulled to a stop at the foot of the steps.
"Not Commander Williams,"
Cade nodded.
"I'm Novitiate Parkins. Captain Stanton asked me to take you to his study immediately upon arrival."
The team was escorted into a large room, tastefully decorated in dark woods and fabrics. A heavy oak desk sat before a large bay window that looked out on marble statuary standing in the center of the well-lit grounds. An area rug surrounded by several armchairs was arranged in front of the fireplace on the opposite side of the room. A short, stocky man in his mid-40s, with dark hair cut in a military fashion, stood behind the desk and came forward immediately as the other men entered the room, introducing himself as Knight Captain Stanton. He shook each man's hand, only hesitating briefly when he came to Cade.
"So my reputation precedes me."
"Please, have a seat."
"Thank you, Captain, but that's not necessary. We've been on alert for the last several days now, and really just want to grab the chance to get some rest. A few spare rooms and access to the network is all that we require."
"Of course, Commander. I'll have Parkins here get you situated. If there is anything else you need, please don't hesitate to ask."
Cade shook the captain's hand once more and followed Parkins out of the office, his man at his heels. Back out in the hallway, Cade dismissed the others just as the bells rang for Compline. Despite being tired, Riley, Olson, and Duncan joined several of the locals for the evening mass, all of them feeling the need to reconnect with their faith and purpose in light of what they had seen and heard that day. The sermon was about duty and honor in times of strife, appropriate for the circumstances, and Duncan felt the weight on his soul lift slightly as he settled into the familiar rhythms of the Latin responses. Several times during the service, he turned his head to look back into the crowd gathered in the sanctuary, trying to locate Cade, but the commander was nowhere to be found. After the ceremony, he raised the issue with Riley as they moved off down the hallway toward their assigned quarters.
"No, you didn't miss him. He wasn't there."
"Oh."
"The commander hasn't attended mass in quite some time."
Duncan reached out and grabbed the other man by the elbow, stopping him.
"He doesn't attend mass? Why not?"
A senior Templar officer not attending regular service was highly unusual. Riley gazed at him silently for a moment, weighing his answer, then pulled free with a jerk of his arm.
"He just doesn't. Leave it at that."
Duncan should have expected it, but the realization that most of the rumors about his new commanding officer might just be true left him almost breathless. He slumped against the nearest wall, his thoughts in turmoil. He'd only been with the unit a few days, and already he'd been forced to deal with sorcerers, revenants, and a commanding officer who'd seemingly turned his back on the Lord. It was almost too much to take. Still, he had little choice. The Preceptor had agreed to his reassignment for a reason, and he'd do his best to live up to his superior's expectations. Yet as he walked off to his quarters, he was unable to banish either his growing sense of discomfort or the feeling of Cade's teeth clamped tightly on his arm. Later that night, Riley shook Cade awake.
"We got trouble."
Cade nodded and ordered him to assemble the rest of Echo Team sergeants in a conference room for an immediate meeting. When he arrived, Cade joined them at the table.
"Talk to me."
"About 30 minutes ago, we received a call from Father Joseph Burns, pastor of St. Margaret's in Broward Township. Burns is one of our local contacts. He was working late in his office at the rear of the church when a noise out front caught his attention. Concerned about vandalism, he wandered into the sanctuary to find someone standing before the altar and staring in fascination at the cross above it. Father Burns called out to the intruder, asking him what he wanted. At the sound of the priest's voice, the figure spun around and charged, at which point the good father got the fright of his life. The priest kept his wits about him and managed to outmaneuver the intruder, trapping him in the sacristy to the right of the altar. He took these with his digital camera."
Olsen passed a folder across the table to Cade. Inside were a series of photographs, obviously printed out on a home computer. Even so, they told the tale quite eloquently. Shot through a small window in the door leading to the sacristy, the photos were of a man who'd obviously been dead for several months. His hair had fallen out in clumps, exposing skin covered with a thin patina of mold. One eye stared at the camera. The other was nothing more than a gaping socket. He was pounding on the other side of the window glass with what was left of his right hand, the bones of the fourth and fifth fingers clearly visible. Small bits of flesh were left on the glass after every blow.
We've had a few other scattered reports intercepted through police bands. Mysterious shapes glimpsed roaming through the woods, children being frightened by a stranger looking in through the windows, that sort of thing. I'm willing to bet they were all caused by the same individual.
After glancing at the photos, Cade passed them to the rest of his assembled team, letting them each take a good long look. He stared off into space for several long moments while they did so, lost in thought.
Okay, here's what we're gonna do.
Cade emerged from the manor house 20 minutes later to find a Black Hawk helicopter warming up on the front lawn. The vehicle's exterior was painted in dark colors and had neither identification nor insignia. Riley stood by the open door, his superior's Kevlar vest and communications rig in one hand. Crossing the lawn, Cade ducked under the rotating blades and took the items from his sergeant. He slipped into the vest, pulled the straps tight, then climbed aboard, finding a seat next to Olsen.
How we doing?
Olsen had his laptop open, his fingers dancing across the keyboard as he monitored external traffic through the communications net and didn't look up from the screen as he replied.
We're good. I've touched base with Father Burns. His guest is still locked up tight in the sacristy.
Cade nodded his understanding and turned to look out the still open door. The Black Hawk was moving quickly through the night, following the Ohio River as it made its way north. Clouds could be seen on the horizon, but for the moment, the weather was fine and visibility was good. At their current rate of speed, he estimated it would be about a 10-minute journey to Broward Township. Leaving the river behind, the pilot cut across country at treetop level. It was only a moment or two before the white spire of a church steeple could be seen in the distance. The church was set at the edge of town on a large stretch of property surrounded by a thick grove of elms. It was far enough away from the rest of the community that they ran little risk of being seen, so Cade had the pilot set down momentarily on the back lawn. Cade and his men quickly disembarked, and the pilot took the chopper back up again to wait high overhead for their signal. As the four knights approached, the rear door of the rectory opened, silhouetting the man standing there waiting for them.
Father Burns, Commander Williams.
Oh, thank God you've arrived, Commander. This way, please.
The priest looked askance at the weapons the men carried, but he made no comment about their presence as he led them through the rectory and into the church proper.
It's been quiet in there for the last 15 minutes.
Burns indicated the door of the sacristy with his hand. Cade stepped up and peered inside. The room was small. A set of floor-to-ceiling cabinets stood opposite a waist-high counter containing a sink with wooden cupboard bolted to the wall above it. Against the far wall crouched the revenant. It was holding a purple stole, obviously taken from the pile of vestments that littered the floor in front of the open cabinets. Intent on its prize, the creature didn't appear to notice him. Cade stepped away from the window and looked at the others.
Okay, I want standard entry procedure. Olsen, you've got the door. Riley, you're with me. Duncan, I want you on overwatch. If it gets by us, it will be up to you to stop it.
Cade removed his gun and handed it to Father Burns.
Hold this for me, will ya?
Aren't you going to need this?
Nah.
Cade pulled two flashbangs off his belt.
We need to take this thing alive, if you can call it that. Riley, when Olsen opens the door, I'll toss the flashbangs. I want you to follow with two more. Hopefully, there'll be enough to bring the thing down. As soon as they go off, we rush in and secure it.
Commonly used by law enforcement groups worldwide, the flashbangs were designed to emit a blinding light while at the same time punishing the eardrums with a loud crack. Cade had always pictured it as being caught between a thunderclap and a lightning bolt. The assault was enough to send most suspects to their knees, their senses reeling. He hoped it would have the same effect on the revenant.
If we get in there and things go to shit, don't you hesitate to take it down.
Roger that.
We ready?
The other three men nodded.
All right then, let's do it!
As the priest moved deeper into the nave so that he was well out of the way, the other four men got into position. Kate and Riley on the right-hand side of the door, Olsen in front of it, key in hand. Duncan stood several feet back, his gun pointed directly ahead in case the creature somehow got past the others. Kate counted it down on his fingers. One, two, three. On four, Olsen slid the key smoothly into the lock, gave it a sharp twist, and pulled the door partially open, giving the others time to toss their flashbangs into the room before slamming it shut once more. Suddenly, Kate and Riley were rushing inside, Olsen at their heels. A few moments later, they stepped back out of the sacristy, carrying the Revenant between them, its hands and feet secured with zip ties and the purple stole it had been holding, doubling as a gag. Cade received his weapon from the grateful Father Burns, while Riley called the chopper in for the extraction. The priest watched from the rectory door once more, as the Templars crossed the lawn, tossed their captive into the back of the helicopter, and lifted off without a backward glance.